This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, disciplined or chaotic, agreeable or argumentative, we've all got parts of our personality that we like and some maybe not so much. Our guest shares the science behind personality and her 3-year experiment to change hers. Now, since Russia invaded Ukraine in late February, over 3 million Ukrainians have fled the country. That's today, as of today, according to the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. It's one of the fastest developing refugee crises in recent history. Over half those refugees have gone to neighboring Poland. The population of Warsaw, Poland's capital, has increased nearly 20% since the invasion a few weeks ago. Our next guest is in Poland now, where he's helping his parents and other Ukrainian refugees get their bearings. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see Europe do to help Ukrainian refugees? The U.S. is currently allowing Ukrainians who are already in the country to stay for 18 months. Should the U.S. do more? Do you have family or friends in Ukraine or fleeing Ukraine right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Andrei Ivanov is an associate professor of history at UW-Platteville. He specializes in the Soviet Union and Russia. Andrei is joining us from Krakow, Poland. Andrei, thanks a lot for making time for us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me here.
First of all, how are your parents doing now?
They're okay. They're resting. They need a lot of rest.
Can you share their story? They fled Ukraine. You were there in Poland to meet them.
Yes, they escaped out of the capital, Kyiv, right as it was being surrounded from the western side by the Russian troops. They escaped from the area in the northwest suburbs right outside of Kyiv, and it was a harrowing escape. It was a very difficult journey, and they're not young, obviously, and it's been horrible several days for them. A ride, then a bus, than a refugee train, and a lot of refugee trains going west are flooded, are overwhelmed. The doors don't open because there's just so many people there. They have to wait for a train that can take them in. Then getting to the Polish border and waiting for a train or a bus across Polish border, it's been a very, very difficult and long journey for them.
I'm glad your parents are there and well now. What are you seeing? How many people are showing up in Krakow, where you are now, from Ukraine?
A lot. So Krakow is the largest Polish city that's also closest to the border. So, I mean, Warsaw is the largest city in Poland, but Krakow, among the larger cities, is the one that's closest to the Ukrainian border. And I would say at least 1 million Ukrainians have either passed through Krakow or had stayed here or stayed in the area. So I hear Ukrainian on the streets everywhere. I see Ukrainian people everywhere in Krakow, and it's sort of the city on essentially that's doing most of the processing and welcoming of Ukrainians coming through Przemysl, a town on the border, and then going to other locations in Europe.
This is one of the biggest surges of refugees that I could find fastest in recent memory. What is life like for Ukrainians in Krakow right now?
They're trying to find place to sleep. It's been very hard. I've talked to some colleagues at Jagiellonian University today. I was giving a lecture at the university. And this is really, really sad. I went to a bus station and people are sleeping on the floor and it's not heated. And then there's a train station here in Krakow that's an old building of the train station. And in the basement, they just set up mattresses and people sleeping on floors and mattresses. It's very hard to find housing. You know, the city of Krakow is 779,000 people. When you have 1 million people coming through Krakow and look for temporary housing or permanent housing, this is very difficult. But the Polish people are very welcoming, and they are opening up their homes and they're opening up their hearts and they're helping and they're feeding. And the students at the university in Krakow here are very active in volunteer work, in help, in finding clothing. A lot of stores, I see things, basic things, pharmacies are empty because they are trying to buy up materials, you know, or medications for the refugees who couldn't take them with them. If you have only an hour to pack up your bags and leave your home, my parents had about a couple hours to leave. What are you going to take? Well, if you forget medication you're taking or something else or some warm clothing, you have to get it here now because you can't go back home. So the volunteers in Krakow are helping the refugees here in every way they can. There's a lot of mobilization of resources here on the ground, and I'm very impressed. Poland is not a wealthy country. It is relatively, it's relatively okay, but it's not a wealthy country, and they've been pouring their hearts out helping people here.
You mentioned things left behind. I know there have been concerns where some borders require vaccine requirements, a lot of other kinds of documentation. If you left, say, an apartment building just before it was shelled, you might not have grabbed that and you can't go back and get it. Are you seeing problems with any kind of documentation for people as they've had to flee, as you said, on very short notice?
Yes. Yeah, so people who are coming to Poland or any EU country are not required to show vaccination records if they have lost it or they cannot access the Ukrainian health system database to access their vaccination records. They're not required to show it. I was in Krakow airport today and just I talked to some airline workers, and they're saying that they are asking Ukrainians who are trying to make it to the United States. And if they are not accompanied by U.S. citizens, they have to show vaccination papers in order to enter the United States, even if they have U.S. visas, U.S. non-immigrant visas. So the airport workers are asking Ukrainians coming to the United States to show their vaccination papers because the United States has not waived that requirement, unlike Canada. Canada has waived the vaccination requirement for Ukrainians fleeing to Canada completely, but not United States at the moment. Although there is a sort of a waiver for Ukrainians who are accompanied by U.S. citizens and they have lost their vaccination papers or whatever, they can come into the United States without that certificate of proof. Yeah.
We're talking to Andrei Ivanov, Associate Professor of History at UW-Platteville. Right now, he's in Krakow, Poland. His parents are refugees from Ukraine. He's met them there, talking to other refugees as well. You could join in if you have a question for Andrei. If you have contacts in Ukraine yourself, people you're worried about, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on what you want to see the U.S. and Europe do to help refugees from Ukraine? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Andrei, I assume people kind of are maybe in a state of shock a little bit of having to flee so quickly. That said, what are people saying about the Russian invasion of Ukraine?
People are very shocked by it, the intensity of it and the brutality. People just do not understand what is Putin trying to achieve by invading Ukraine and bringing such a horrible civilian toll and so much destruction. People just don't understand. It's kind of, people are in a state of shock. It's very hard to sort of rationalize this on many levels. And it's something that also, I should say, was unexpected for a lot of people. It was completely unexpected. The scope, the scale of it, and also the reasons are completely, people are asking, what in the world does Putin want? And why, you know, why is this happening?
As a historian now of Russia and the Soviet Union, from what in Russia's history do you point toward as context to try to help make sense of this invasion?
Well, there are not as many parallels, but we have in 20th century, for example, there were examples when Soviet Union would invade a country that was getting out of line. For example, Hungary, 1956, the Soviet army invaded Hungary and pounded Budapest, and Imre Nagy, the leader of Hungary, was hoping for the support from the West, was hoping for the support from Britain and France. And the Europeans were at that point involved in the Suez Canal fiasco. And so there was no help coming from the West. And Hungarians pleaded, and there were Hungarian refugees going out to Austria and Western Europe and so on. So there's one sort of parallel here that we see, but there are other, of course, examples like that. This is what a lot of historians would say, sort of Russia's show of muscle or flexing muscle to kind of demonstrate that they have a claim to a certain area in Eastern Europe that where their geopolitical interests must reign supreme. So, yeah, historically speaking, there are some parallels, but they're not sort of the best parallels out there.
Andrei Ivanov is with us, associate professor of history at UW-Platteville, specializing in the former Soviet Union and Russia. Right now, he's joining us from Krakow, Poland, to talk about Ukrainian refugees, including his parents. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think the international community should handle a refugee crisis like this? What if anything, do you want to see the U.S. do to help? What do you want to know about what's going on in Ukraine right now and the flow of refugees into Poland? And do you have a personal connection with Ukraine yourself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk now with Andrei Ivanov, associate professor of history at UW-Platteville, specializing in the Soviet Union and Russia. Andrei's joining us right now from Krakow, Poland, where he's involved with efforts to help Ukrainian refugees coming into the city, including his own parents. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question about Ukrainian refugees, what life is like for them in Poland right now. If you have people you're concerned about in Ukraine, let us know. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Andrei, could you talk about your decision to go to Poland to try to meet up with your parents as they made this effort to cross the border? What was that like?
Well, it was it wasn't difficult, of course, buying tickets and flying into Poland logistically. That's fairly easy. There's a nonstop flight from Chicago to Warsaw, thanks to LOT Polish Airlines. But my parents are not young, as I mentioned, and they have my father has a pacemaker and so on, and they need help. So I realized I need to come in here and help them and logistically and look after the housing situation and so on. I also have colleagues at the university here in Krakow, at Jagiellonian University, and I wanted to come here and do as much as I can to help or coordinate or find out what the needs are. So when I go back to Wisconsin, I can tell people who are interested about those needs. And so that's the efforts overall. I mean, I'm not the only one here. There are, I've met countless other Americans who are here helping their relatives, their family members, their friends coming in from Ukraine. Canadians too. I've met Canadians as well. I've met people who are part of parts of humanitarian groups. They are distributing aid. They're helping setting up camps on the border. They're involved in all kinds of outreach and health, or I should say medical help and so on. So I'm sort of part of this larger wave of people that have been coming to Poland in the recent days and trying to connect to refugees coming across the border.
If people are listening and want to do something to help from where you're sitting, what are the best ways for somebody, say, in Wisconsin to help?
Well, one thing is to contact well-known organizations that if we want to start with people who have no connections to, let's say, Ukrainian diaspora in the United States at all, then there are a number of organizations, including Red Cross, including Caritas, who do excellent work in terms of helping refugees and helping people fleeing Ukraine in general. Of course, one of the best ways to help is so-called people-to-people networks. And those networks are usually found in Ukrainian diaspora or sometimes also Polish diaspora, local churches, local organizations, local cultural venues that have connections. So if, let's say, you have a Ukrainian or Eastern European organization in your area, or a church in your area, they would be most likely already connected to somebody here on the ground in Poland or somebody there on the ground in Ukraine. There's a lot of people-to-people help that's going on. And so there are a number of ways to get involved, from helping well-known international organizations that do provide help to refugees, like Caritas and Rescue Committee and Red Cross, to local organizations or people-to-people networks that do work, carry out work sort of every day and go there and so on. And I should say, on the plane flying from Chicago to Warsaw, I met a lot of those people who are doing people-to-people sort of work. They've had somebody in their neighborhood give them supplies or medical help or money, and they're bringing that over to Ukraine or to Ukrainian border right now, because they know some people and they're sort of it's within there, or they have relatives and so on. So there's a lot of outreach going on right now. So there is actually several ways to help, and also to write to legislators to bring this more to the attention of U.S. government and whatever humanitarian and refugee legal status and processing that needs to be done from the side of the United States side. That also is something that's very important that people could get involved with.
Andrei Ivanov is with us, associate professor of history at UW-Platteville in Krakow, Poland, now working with, talking to refugees from Ukraine, including his parents. Andrei, even if the war ended somehow tomorrow, there's still a lot of destruction in Ukraine. What are people thinking about as they think about their hopes to move back home?
Well, a majority of people that I talk to want to move back to their homes. They do not want to sleep on the floor of a Krakow underground train station with rats and no heating. That's pretty much the majority of people want to go back to their homes. As soon as the war is over, people will look forward to that. Now, the homes that they will see are going to be different from the homes before the war. And so Ukraine will need help with rebuilding and reconstruction. The refugee waves that EU is facing right now, or Europe is facing right now, is really the largest wave since 1945. And if Ukraine is going to have the kind of destruction that Europe had after 1945, it's going to take several years to rebuild, and it's going to take efforts similar to Marshall Plan to rebuild and bring Ukraine back, or make Ukraine help Ukraine rebuild itself and bring itself back from the ashes. It's really we don't know how long this war is going to last. The longer it lasts, the more destruction will take place.
Are Ukrainians in Poland right now able to stay in contact with friends, family who are still in Ukraine?
Yes, and a number of European mobile operators and Ukrainian mobile operators have waived roaming fees. And so there's actually an opportunity to call Ukrainians in Poland from Ukraine or from other countries, and the other way around, call to Ukraine. There's a lot of communication going on, and mobile work networks make that easier. And a lot of mobile operators are financially waiving roaming fees and various other access fees for calling to call Ukraine.
Let's bring on a caller. John is with us in Lake Halley. John, hi.
Yeah. I was just curious if there was, if I have an extra room in my house, there was a way to actually house a Ukrainian, house a Ukrainian family.
John, thanks for the call. Andre, I don't know if we're far enough along the process here. If people like John wanted to offer up a room to Ukrainian refugees in the U.S., do you know if there's ways to do that yet?
I don't know, but this is, thank you, John. This is a very generous offer. If the United States is going to start the process of admitting Ukrainian refugees, this is, of course, always takes time. Canada has sped up the process by offering Ukrainians temporary resident visas. But if the United States is going to open up and bring refugees in a similar manner as, let's say some refugees from Afghanistan were airlifted. If, let's say, something like this happens, then yes, there will be plenty of opportunities for folks to open up their homes. Right now, there is, of course, the ocean that separates the continents. In Poland, the situation is different. And so what John is doing right now, offering his room, is what millions of Polish people are doing right now, offering their rooms in their apartments, in their homes, in their vacation homes or whatever. They're offering their rooms. Hotels are offering their rooms to Ukrainians. And the country has taken in, I would say, at least half, if not more, of the entire refugee flow into Europe. So Polish people are doing exactly what John has offered right now. They are saying, please come on in, family, you know, stay with us, and we have a room available. And so that is something that's amazing that I'm seeing in Poland here. And yeah, once there is a refugee resettlement program or something like this with the United States government facilitating something like this, yes, then it would be possible to open up homes. I should also mention that the United States does have a smaller program for refugees from Ukraine and former Soviet Union known as Lautenberg or Arlen Specter Amendment, and that needs to be reauthorized by the Congress every year. And that brings a few thousands of refugees from Ukraine every year. But that program has a very good sort of network of resettlement and support in general. Yeah.
Andre, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us. Best to your parents and the other refugees you are working with.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
That's Andre Ivanov, Associate Professor of History at UW-Platteville. He specializes in the Soviet Union and Russia. He joined us today from Krakow, Poland, where he's helping his parents and other Ukrainian refugees get their bearings. Follow more of the latest news from Ukraine online at WPR.org. We have stories from our colleagues at NPR bringing us up to date on the latest events there. If you have a personal story to share, a connection with Ukraine, we'd love to hear from you. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Share your story with us. We could pass it on to our news team as well if you are interested in talking to them. Again, email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, there are a lot of scams out there targeting consumers, including fake discount offers, tax time traps, and a whole lot more. Find out what's out there in the world of scams and how you can avoid the con artists. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, 2 years into the pandemic, Dr. Anthony Fauci joins the show with a look at the latest COVID trends, advisories for safety, and what the future could hold. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, have you ever had a moment where you wished you could be different? Maybe a new social situation where you let your shyness get the best of you, or a time when you let someone walk all over you and you wish you'd spoken up? Our next guest says she's had her own versions of those kind of moments, and that got her interested in the science behind personality. She took a closer look at that in a recent piece for The Atlantic and set out on a 3-month experiment to see if she could change her own personality. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What parts of your personality do you love? What parts would you change if you could? Have you ever tried consciously to change something about your personality? Introverts out there, have you tried to be extroverts? I can relate. Did it work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Olga Hazan is a staff writer at The Atlantic, author of the book Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. Olga, welcome back to Central Time.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
What got you interested in changing your own personality, Olga?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the pandemic happened, and at first, you know, like many introverts, I was sort of like, yay, I don't have to go see people, you know, but then I kind of was thinking, you know, am I really that introverted? Like, I kind of do find myself missing human interaction and maybe wanting to expand my social circle a little bit. And I also, I mean, I've just always known that I've been very neurotic my whole life. And it definitely has a detrimental effect on my personality and my life. So I wanted to see if I could reduce my neuroticism as well.
And as always, Olga, when you did this, it wasn't just about you. You went and looked at a lot of the science here. And there have been disagreements, changing ideas in the psychological world over whether we can change our personalities at all. What did you find out?
Yeah, so I think there's like sort of this folk wisdom, that people never change, you'll always be the same. And I don't want to overstate things. Like it's likely that you will be recognizable, from the time you're in your early 20s to the time you're in your 60s. But it is still likely that you'll change on at least one personality trait over that period of time. And actually, scientists who have looked into this and who have studied personality change have found that people can actually kind of nudge their personalities into the direction that they would like it to go, basically by behaving in the way that they would like their new personality to be. So if you want to be really bubbly and outgoing, you have to go to a lot of parties and meet a lot of people and talk to people and say hello and try new things and like all those other scary things that introverts hate. But eventually that can actually become part of your personality.
Let's talk about what constitutes personality. You went for your experiment with this kind of five category process. You've already touched on them a little bit. Can you sum up what the five are in kind of a Cliff's Notes version?
Yeah, definitely. So, scientists think that your personality consists of five factors. So there's it's the acronym is OCEAN, if you want an easy way to remember them. So the first one is openness to experience, which is sort of how kind of down with new types of cuisines and movies and music you are. Then there's conscientiousness, which is getting places on time and making plans and getting things done. There's extroversion, which is pretty self-explanatory. Agreeableness, which is sort of how cuddly, touchy-feely you are. And neuroticism, which is the one that I struggle with, which is sort of this proclivity toward anxiety and depression.
We're talking to Olga Hazan from The Atlantic about her 3-month experiment to change her personality and what she learned about the science of personality along the way. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions or maybe your own reflections on how your personality has changed over time on accident or on purpose. Call 800-642-1234. Olga, you picked a few of those traits, tried to change them. What were some of the operational ways? How did you actually try to start changing these facets of your personality?
Yeah, well, so one of the things that I tried that I actually ended up really enjoying was I took an improv class. So if you're someone like me who's a total control freak, and is also very introverted and doesn't like to put themselves out there, improv is a great way to not allow you to do any of that like all at once. So it forces you to kind of get up and out in front of people, behave in these like really silly ways. And then often in improv things go wrong, like thus the improvisational nature of it. Your scene partner doesn't say what you expect them to say, or just something unexpected happens. So it kind of requires you to roll with the punches a little bit. So that's one that I actually really enjoyed. I also took an anger management class, and I tried meditating as well.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Brian is with us in Green Bay. Brian, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call. I love this topic.
Yeah, what's your experience, Brian?
So I actively tried to and succeeded in not just breaking out of my shell, but feeling like I completely smashed it. When I was in high school, I was part of a foreign student ambassadorship program known as People to People, and I went to Australia with 40 other people from a whole bunch of different schools. And as a result, I came back and I went to college and actively was not my introverted self. I was a t-shirt with witty quips guy with baggy jeans. And when I was in college, I was polos and smiles and khakis and nice shoes. And as a result, I had a great first semester in college. I was very amicable. I was genial. I became more empathetic to other people who were also introverted. But ultimately, I kind of stepped back. I just felt like I gained skills that allowed me to kind of be more flexible in more situations than I was before when I was 100% that angsty teenager in high school.
Wow. Brian, thank you so much for sharing that. And Olga, he kind of is spoiling some of your conclusions. I think you found similar things with your extroversion experiences when he talked about skills there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I love what this caller said because, yeah, so it's not, so he kind of learned how to be an extrovert, which is totally in line with what a lot of experts say, which is that you can kind of learn these skills, and learn these abilities so that when the time or the situation calls for being an extrovert, you can do it. You don't have to be kind of afraid of the networking reception or what have you, that because you understand that that is within you. And even if you occasionally need to retreat and be kind of in a in a quiet room by yourself, so that you can go back to being an introvert for a little bit, you at least have those skills so you know how to do it if the situation calls for it.
Brian, thanks a lot for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Olga, let's step into that anger management class now. This is something that where people go in the hopes of changing their personality, or somebody hopes they're going to change that personality. You mentioned a lot of your classmates, unlike you, were there by a court order. Did you take skills out of that helped you? You're not like I think a smash stuff in public kind of person, but did you get skills there?
Yeah, I mean, one of the most important things that I understood from anger management was just that anger is about expectations. So, like a lot of things that make us angry are actually because our expectations were foiled in some way. So, there was like a really interesting moment early on in the class where they talked about whether traffic makes us angry. And it was kind of funny because I think the instructors expected us all to say like, yeah, I hate traffic, but no one said that because we all live in this very congested area of the country where there's always a lot of traffic. And we were all sort of like, yeah, I expect there to be traffic and it doesn't really bother me when it happens. So that's kind of when we realized that, a lot of things in life are kind of like that traffic that you can kind of learn to expect, and maybe it doesn't bother you so much.
Okay, now how did you operationalize that in your life, Olga, for that moment where you did find yourself getting angry because the world didn't match your expectations, which is going to happen to all of us sometimes?
Yeah, so another strategy for, yeah, so definitely like you can't always have your expectations match reality. So one thing they learned that's been kind of helpful for me is actually this sounds a little strange, but it's plunging your hands or your face into ice water, which I don't know exactly why it works, but apparently it kind of like conveys signals through the vagus nerve, which tells you to kind of calm down, or it kind of like shocks your system a little bit. So if you are in a place where you have ice water handy, I have done this before. I will just stick my face in ice water. Another option, if you, I don't know if you, your lakes are still frozen or whatever, you
Oh,
can
yeah.
go, just kind of go put your face in some really cold water.
They're pretty cold.
And that kind of, resets you a little bit.
That's going to be hard for the driver who's upset about the traffic, though.
Right?
That ice
Yeah,
bucket of
yeah.
water is just not going to work.
Yeah.
We're talking to Olga Hazad. She's a staff writer at The Atlantic. She's with us to talk about an experiment she tried recently to see if she could change her personality in 3 months, what she learned about the science of personality along the way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. One of those categories of personality, extrovert or introvert. Does one of those describe you? Do you like being that way? Have you tried to push yourself in one direction or another? How did it go? Have you made a conscious effort to change something about your personality? How did it go? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with writer Olga Hazan from The Atlantic with us today to talk about a recent experiment where she tried to change her personality in a few different ways in just a few months. You can join in at 800-642-1234. One of the most common things, maybe, are you an introvert? Who tried to get out and talk to people at a bar or whatever? How did it go? Were you able to? Did you want to make that change? How did it work for you? Have you tried to dial down anger or anxiety? Meditation? Was that one of the tools you used? 800-642-1234. If you have a story to share or a question for our guest, 800-642-1234, as we talk about some of the science and psychology behind our personality. Olga, I just mentioned meditation. That's one of the things you tried. I think you were skeptical. You went to another person who'd been skeptical, Dan Harris, author of 10% Happier. He told us about his meditation journey on this show. Can you tell us how that worked, how you try to use it to change your personality?
Yeah, so the big thing that made a difference for me was, so for me, meditation, I guess to back up, was very unsuccessful. So if I just turned off my phone and sat, you know, set a timer for 10 minutes and sat there, I would just ruminate about all my problems for 10 minutes, which is not especially helpful. So I was sort of like, how do people actually meditate? So I tweeted about this, and Dan kind of messaged me, and I downloaded his app, which really made a difference. So essentially, what I found helps is guided meditations, which is sort of someone, you're mostly meditating, and it's mostly just a quiet time for yourself. But there's a meditation teacher who's sort of walking you through and saying, okay, now picture yourself, you know, like in a river that's like really calm or whatever, or, you know, now imagine, you know, tell yourself that like everything's going to be okay. And like, I know it sounds really cheesy, but for me that really worked. And these guided meditations helped me kind of stay with the meditation as opposed to just veering off into anxiety land, which is what I was doing before.
Did that end up helping you when you weren't doing the guided meditation?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's hard to say. So I did become less neurotic according to the tests that I took before and after. So I do think it, quote unquote, worked. But it, you know, it's hard to say whether that was because of the meditation, or I was doing all of this journaling. Like whenever I was anxious about something, I had to like, counteract it with, you know, two reasons why it might work out well. Or, you know, if I thought someone was mad at me, I had to, you know, come up with two reasons why they actually might just be having a bad day or something like that. So I was sort of constantly retraining my mind to break out of this loop of anxiety that has really been with me my entire life.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Terry is with us in Racine. Terry, hello.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
I thought it was interesting when you talked about changing personalities. I was a real introvert in high school. I didn't feel like I was one of the crowd. You know, I was bullied a little bit, but I wasn't one of the real popular cute little girls. I had a deep voice. I played, you know, I was kind of a tomboy, and I turned into a real introvert. And then I got into, I was an engineer for a biomedical company, and I had to start talking to people in, you know, surgical suites and to the FDA. And I found that by practicing, getting in front of a mirror and practicing over and over again, I started getting a lot of confidence. And pretty soon, I started actually enjoying it and volunteering to go talk to people because it was kind of fun. You know, when you could get an audience to laugh with you and do things, and it really changed my personality around.
Terry, I got to ask though, do you still find it exhausting to get up in front of a whole bunch of people, or are you just roll with it now?
I just kind of roll with it. You know, I think COVID kind of tempered that a little bit because I haven't been around people and I kind of have been avoiding people. But, you know, before that, we'd be on trips and I'd get in the elevator and I'd see somebody and I'd travel with a friend of mine. And he would say, you know, you would talk to a beat, you know, sitting on a table, because I would just start talking to people. So it kind of rolled over into my other life. Like I said, it's been tempered with COVID, but, you know, it's actually kind of fun once you start doing it because people like to talk about themselves, and you can find out a lot of really interesting things about people, and I like to hear their stories, so it's been a good thing.
Terry, thanks a lot for sharing that. It reminds me, Olga, another part of your introvert-extrovert story was part of your routine was you would try to just walk up and talk to a group of strangers at a bar. I've spent a fair amount of time at bars. That's something I still wouldn't feel comfortable doing.
Yeah, it was very weird. It was actually the activity that I enjoyed least. I have never voluntarily talked to strangers in a bar except for a story. And so not even for this story, but just like, hey, I'm here at this bar as a reporter. And what do you think about the latest law that says blah, 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 you know, and I don't even really like doing that. And that's my job. So This made me really uncomfortable. I feel like maybe my discomfort was palpable. It also was a kind of, I think, maybe the wrong setting for this. Like, it was a little bit more of a dinner spot than like a dive bar where people are kind of shooting the shit and there's a big row of people, you know. It's also in DC where people are a little more closed off. Still, I tried to make conversation with the bartender and I wasn't able to, but the two people sitting next to me were. So I don't know. I might just need a little more practice with this one, but it did not go very well.
Talking to Olga Kazan from The Atlantic, looking at her 3-month experiment to change her personality, what she learned about the psychology and science of personality along the way. Olga, are you a different Olga now?
You know, I really think I am. Like, I think in particular, it's not so much that you wouldn't recognize me. You know, I'm totally, you know, I just think that my view toward myself is a little bit different. Like, it really made me feel a lot more empowered. And it made me feel like if there is something about my life or about my habits or behaviors that I don't like, that they're within my power to control. So it kind of made me feel like whenever I get down about, you know, I don't have that many friends or I don't really have any hobbies or I kind of, you know, my life is kind of boring. It kind of made me feel like I have the ability to really change that. And that was kind of one of the most gratifying things about doing this experiment.
Do other people in your life notice a difference?
I did ask my boyfriend if he noticed me behaving differently, and he said that I seem more grateful and more calm. He said that toward the end of the experiment. But I have to qualify that with the fact that he is a very positive person who has a very different personality than me. I do not know if that's colored by the fact that he sees everything in this kind of rosy way.
So, Olga, if somebody out there is listening thinking, yeah, there's this element of my personality that I would want to change, if I could change it myself, yeah, let's go for it. How would you advise them to get started on that process?
So you could just read my article and try some of the stuff that I did. but there's a really great researcher out there, Nate Hudson, who has done a lot of work on this. If you're able at all to read kind of scientific literature, you can kind of read through his studies and see kind of what he recommends. But otherwise, like if you're not into all that, you know, you could just imagine what would a person who is really conscientious act like, or what would a person who's really extroverted act like? And you can kind of just do that stuff. Like, you don't really need permission from some professor to just behave differently. And behaving differently is really all that personality is. So I don't know. That's kind of my recommendation, is sort of fake it till you make it.
I wonder, going through this process of consciously trying to change some parts of your personality that you thought could use improvement, did you end up in a place where some of it was like, you know what, I'm going to accept it. That's who I am. And that's okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm always going to have these tendencies toward neuroticism and introversion. I don't think that I'm ever going to completely eliminate those, you know, but I think that's okay. Like, I think as long as I understand how to turn the dial, you know, up and down on some of these things, you know, and to know that it's not permanent, or at least that I can flex myself in different situations. That to me is a really comforting feeling.
And just in our last half a minute, is it, you do this a lot in your work, is it weird to share this deeply personal stuff with the world?
It was a little weird. Yeah, I guess so, maybe. But I don't know. It's hard to write an article like this without really revealing all your warts and all.
Fair enough. Olga, thanks for joining us again. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
That's Olga Kazan, a staff writer at The Atlantic. She was with us today to talk about the science behind our personalities. And she put that science to the test with a 3-month experiment to see if she could change parts of her own personality. If you have a story like that to share, there's still time. You can do it over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates in an effort to slow down inflation. What could that mean for you and for the wider economy? Join the conversation with your thoughts and your questions. and it's a massive dinosaur battle featuring the Tyrannosaurus Rex and the latest research about T-Rex and how it's changing our understanding of the big dinosaur. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time.